Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here again today for episode number 417. In just a few moments, I'll share a conversation I had with Gabrielle Elise Jimenez. She is a hospice nurse, end-of-life doula, and a conscious dying educator, and we'll be talking about her brand new book, Dignity Day, which is a guide for supporting patients using medical aid in dying. And it's a great conversation. I think you'll really enjoy this one, so stay tuned. I'll get there in just a moment. But first, I wanted to mention once again that this year is the 10th anniversary of End of Life University, and I've created a 10th anniversary mug along with other merchandise that I have in general for End of Life University podcast. And there's a link on the show notes page where you can look at the mugs and t-shirts and a few hats and a hoodie, I think, that I've created. And you can go to eolupodcast.com and you'll find a link there to the merchandise page. So you can go and check that out if you're interested in purchasing anything. It's a great way to support the podcast. I don't make very much money from any of the merch, but it's great to spread the word and also to inspire conversations about end-of-life issues with people to be wearing a t-shirt that says, "Mind if we talk about death?" So be sure to check that out on the podcast show notes page at eolupodcast.com. Also, I wanted to mention I started a little fundraising campaign called $10 for 10 years in honor of this 10th anniversary, and just asking people if you're willing or interested to make a $10 contribution, all of which is going to go toward me purchasing a new laptop, which I'm getting closer and closer to being in an emergent need for, as my laptop is quite old and I'm seeing some of the functions are not working as well now as they should, and it's also not compatible with some newer software. So I'm working toward purchasing a new laptop and along with it a new microphone that that the laptop will support. So I just want to thank some of the people who joined my $10 for 10 years campaign: Bob Norman, Acupuntrix, Suzanne Kilpatrick, Helen Roberts, Molly Bayock, Navalette Monroe, Jennifer Blaylock, Malia Deuce, Amber Sastry, and Joy Sobsack. Thank you all so very much for chipping in $10 for 10 years. Also, I have some new supporters on Patreon: Lorene Reyes, David Easton, Ed Modell, and I want to thank Joan Rolchenfull for increasing your pledge, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced your last name, Joan. And then also, Dan and Judy Dickinson, thank you for buying me some coffees. To all of you, I appreciate your support so very much. It means everything to me. Of course, the financial contribution is very helpful, but also, as I've mentioned before, just emotionally and spiritually, it's very helpful to know that people are listening and that you appreciate the content that I create and are willing to step up and offer just a little bit of support. So thank you again in advance. And now we'll move on with my conversation with Gabby Jimenez, and I will be back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so very excited to welcome my return guest, Gabrielle Elise Jimenez. Gabby is a hospice nurse, an end-of-life doula, and a conscious dying educator. She has written 6 books, most recently End-of-Life Tips and Dignity Day, which we will be discussing today. Gabby believes that anyone can provide care to someone who's dying. You do not have to have a license, but you do need to have the tools. And that is what she hands out in her books, her blog, and on her hospice Facebook page, which now has 140,000 members, which is remarkable. Amazing, Gabby. And Gabby's website is thehospiceheart.net. Her Facebook page is also The Hospice Heart. So, Gabby, I'm just so happy to have a chance to talk to you once again.
I was thinking when you invited me to come back, I was thinking how much I enjoyed our last conversation. So I was so excited today, and I'm honored to be back. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, you're so welcome. Well, I follow you on social media, and every time I see one of your posts or your lovely blogs, you write the nicest blogs. And I think, oh, I want to talk to Gabby again. I need to have Gabby back. But then I heard about your new book, Dignity Day, and realized that's the topic we need to discuss. And this is the perfect thing to cover. And so I think we'll just dive right into it. I did want to give a little disclaimer. We are talking about medical aid in dying, but this podcast won't be about all the legal ramifications and the laws surrounding medical aid in dying. We're not going to cover that topic. And your book doesn't either, right?
No. And there's a reason for that. I think that, you know, each state has a different protocol and it does change, you know, so things do change. And I really didn't want to go in that direction. There's information out there. You can get the protocols. I really want to just do the basics and to maybe help remove some fear and offer clarity.
Yes. And that's exactly what I would like from our conversation together too. So, I mean, I can mention that medical aid in dying, it's legal as far as I know now in about 10 states and Washington, D.C., but people can go to Compassion and Choices to find out more about that. And the other website you mentioned
is ACMAID, which is the Academy of Medical Aid in Dying. And there's a lot of great resources there. There are some wonderful books. I do like Compassion and Choices. There's, it's always current, and the states are different. You know, it's all, most of it is basic, but there are some differences, especially with the time frames and that type of thing. So yes, I think if you want to know about your own state, you should go there.
Exactly. And if you happen to live in a state where medical aid in dying is not legal, it's possible there are people in your state who are working on that. Mm-hmm. And they may love to have volunteers and donors who would help out for that cause. So if it's something someone listening cares about in your own state, you could investigate it and maybe you could make a difference there.
Absolutely. Of course, we want it to get into every state, but there's also some states, and I believe Oregon is one of them, where they no longer require you to be a resident there. So there are one or two states that allow that too. So I don't want people to feel like if it's not yet legal in their state, and I say yet because I'm hopeful, but if it's not, that to pursue options that might make things easier for you, like you could go to another state to do this. Your hands are not tied. You have options.
Exactly. And as you mentioned, our conversation today is really about dispelling fear and trying to just give people an idea of what this experience is like, because you as a hospice nurse, you wrote in your book, you've been with around 100 patients as they've used medical aid in dying.
Yes, both as a nurse and as a doula.
Yeah. So that's incredible. I imagine within 100 patients, you've seen a pretty big spectrum of people who've made the choice. And, you know, you've seen a lot of how this unfolds and a lot of the differences from one person to the next.
Yes. And even though the medications are the same and the process is relatively the same, there are differences. You know, the body does not die the same. And so even when you introduce medications to hasten it, the dying process is still unique to each person. So I have witnessed many different ways that people let go.
Yes, yes, that's so very true. Well, you titled your book, which is, it's a short book that's a guide to basically what to expect if you choose medical aid in dying. And you titled the book Dignity Day. And I wanted to ask you about the title and if you'd share the story of why you chose that title.
Yes, it's a beautiful story. I met a woman several months ago who wanted to do this, but she wasn't ready yet. And she had gone through the protocols, the proper steps. She'd gotten the medication. She put them up on her shelf. She had written on the top of the box, Dignity Day. And it was because, and this is what I try to tell people, when you are given a diagnosis, your autonomy, your voice, and your choice are in many ways taken from you, right? Because as you progress in this illness, you no longer really have a voice. Everyone is making decisions for you and providing care that you can no longer do for yourself. So your autonomy is taken. This option gives you your voice back, gives you autonomy. And for her, it was giving her dignity. It was allowing her the right to make a choice that would bring her peace. But she wasn't ready yet. So she, when we would have conversations, she would say, when Dignity Day comes, this will happen, or I'm waiting for Dignity Day. And I was with her the day that she took her medications. And when she opened the door, I said, it's Dignity Day. And she said, It's Dignity Day. And there was this smile and this sense of peace that she had. She had waited until she was ready. She knew she was ready. And she was able to make a decision, an independent decision for how she wanted to die on her terms and when. She was offered dignity. And that really sticks with me. And so this book is in many ways because of her and so many like her. I think this day when someone can have that option is Dignity Day.
That's such a beautiful story. And I think it really helps dispel the misperception some people have that people who choose medical aid in dying just don't want to be alive anymore. But in fact, they're making the choice because they want to live. They don't have a choice. They are dying. They're going to die. They just want to have a little more control and dignity over when and how that dying takes place. And that's the choice they're making.
You're so right. And I know that there's a lot of controversy about it. And I understand people's hesitation and what they look at this as someone is giving up or they're quitting or they're killing themselves. It's a form of suicide. I mean, there's all kinds of things people say. But at the end of the day, and this is just from my perspective, this person was already dying, but they were suffering in many ways, whether it be physical, emotional, spiritual, all of that is still suffering. And to be given an option to end that suffering on their terms, I think that's kindness. We treat our animals better than we do our human beings. We would never let our animals suffer this way. And yet we become almost selfish in that we're not ready to let someone go. So therefore, just deal with the suffering because that makes more sense. That doesn't make sense to me. I've witnessed suffering, and no one should ever have to do that. No one should ever have to die that way. This option offers people the ability and choice and autonomy to be able to end their suffering and die in peace with grace.
That's just so beautiful. And just something for everyone to remember, not to judge anyone who chooses to use it, because you don't understand the depth and breadth of the reasons why this choice may be right for them. And one thing I have seen, some people who got a lot of peace from knowing that the option was available to them, knowing that they had the medication, whether they decided to use it or not, just knowing that if they reached a point where the suffering was so severe that they couldn't tolerate it, there would be an option for them. And some of those people felt so much peace and comfort in that knowledge, they didn't even end up taking the medication. Absolutely. But it was the very fact that there was an option, there was a choice available that made all the difference.
And that actually relieves people so much so that they're in they find peace with that. And you're right, some of them never take it. Just knowing it's there, it gives them some relief. But the thing, you made a really good point. The truth of the matter is most people want to live. They're not doing this because they don't want to live. They're doing this because they can no longer tolerate the suffering. Mm-hmm.
And I think, there are some general requirements you discuss in the book, and I think it's worth covering those because these would probably apply in every state, but some things that are generally true, and that may help dispel some of these notions. Anyway, one being that I think in most states, just like for admission to hospice, a patient has to have a prognosis of 6 months or less. Is that correct?
Yes. They have to be 18 or over. They have to have a terminal diagnosis of 6 months or less to live. They have to be of sound mind to be able to make a decision, cognitively aware that this is the ending of their life. They have to be able to take the medications themselves, holding the bottle or a cup and drinking it down themselves. And there's so much a part of that. You know, it takes two doctor's letters. It used to be in California, it used to be there was a 14 or 15 day waiting period between the two letters. You can have your primary care physician do it or another hospice doctor. And then 2 weeks later, you have the prescribing physician that will do it, which is usually a medical doctor, a hospice medical director. And now in California, and I think one or two other states now as well, it's been moved down to 48 hours, which is huge. Because at the end of life, time takes on such a whole new meaning, right? When you have less of it left, and a lot can happen in 2 weeks. So to turn it down to 48 hours is such a gift to these families and to the patient themselves, to be able to get the two doctor's letters, get the medications, and do this in a shorter amount of time. Because many people wait till the last minute, just like signing up for hospice. They wait till the last minute to do it. But to plan ahead and to be able to have this set in stone and ready for you if and when you are ready to take it does give relief, but you do have to follow the protocols.
And then each person is able to plan for their dignity day and to whatever degree they want to plan for it. And I don't know, maybe some people don't really plan. Maybe it's more spontaneous when they actually decide to take the medication. Or some, I'm sure, set the date on the calendar and know in advance when it will be.
Some make it a party. They'll have the whole family there. They'll have food. They'll have everyone gathered around. I had a gentleman once who wore this wonderful purple robe. He looked like, well, a little bit like Prince, but a sort of a king, right? And he had his people all around him, and they had a toast of some sort of cocktail, and he made it such a production, and he had it on the calendar. He planned ahead. Some people, they just know, I need to do it on Tuesday. I had one person the other day say, I need to do it tomorrow. I'm ready. I can't wait any longer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, timing, you have to get everything set in stone, and you have to have everything ready and get the medications. The medications are compounded by a compounding pharmacy, so you have to be able to make sure to get that to you, which is out of pocket. You know, it's right now, at least here, it's about $700. It is not covered under the hospice or Medicare benefit, and it's about $700.
And then are there other expenses? Does a medical person need to be present when the person takes the medication?
No, I would not suggest that. You know, I think that a person can choose to take it on their own. There is no law that says they can't. To qualify, they have to still, you know, qualify with all the protocols and to make sure that they're appropriate for it. But no, they can take it by themselves with their family members. I would not recommend that. I have done it. I've been at the bedside as a doula. And even that, I'm not necessarily confident that doulas should be doing it either. I do believe that a doctor and or a nurse should be there because you can't predict what will happen. Most of the time, it's a beautiful, peaceful experience. But if you are not medically trained and have that experience and something happens and you don't know what to do, it's detrimental to the patient, but also to those who are witnessing it. And if you don't have someone there, what if it takes an hour to get someone there? What if it's not as easy to get a nurse or doctor there? I really believe that you should have somebody with clinical experience with this, not just a doctor or nurse, but someone who has actually had experience with this process.
Yes, who knows what to expect and who has even seen many different outcomes and been through a lot of different experiences. So as an end-of-life doula, do you help people during the preparatory phase in a way as they're making this decision, as they're going through these steps? Do you get involved early on with them and become part of that process?
Yes, I, as a doula, the luxury of being a doula is that is time. I get more time with them. I can start at diagnosis way before it even gets to 6 months or less. And so I kind of call it choreographing a beautiful death for them. And it's all based on how they want to be cared for, where they want to be, who they want there. And so I'll choreograph that. But for people who are just doing the medical aid and dying, usually what I'll do is I'll meet them a few days before, meet their family. If I hadn't met them already. And I will kind of pull them together, help them to know what's going to happen, be prepared in that regard. But I also like to do, I'm a ritual and ceremony person, so I will do beautiful ceremonies or plan one that will be involve the family members. But I also like to make a playlist, and I'll give the families homework assignments like, okay, I want you guys to work together to create a playlist if they want one, you know, to have their choice of music there. But mostly it's about preparing the family. I do that as a doula and I do that as a nurse. It's actually this book, The Dignity Day, is very much what I present to families so that they are very well prepared, on the same page, and don't have that uncertainty. I want to answer their questions. I actually really enjoy the curiosity, and I want to answer it. I want to remove any uncertainty or fear. So a lot of my preparation is about, it's about helping them, but also making sure that they can trust me. Trust is really important to me. And I want them to know I know what I'm doing and that I'm here. I always say, I've got you. You're not doing this alone. I'm going to be right here with you. And there's this sense of comfort that they get from that. And the family does as well. Many times when I've met with them, I watch them come closer together because they're not as anxious or uncertain.
That makes so much sense. And for the patient and the family, they're walking into the unknown and uncertain situation, and to have an experienced guide there with them who can answer all the questions, and especially just your calmness and your ability to be present and hold space with them. I'm sure that's very, very comforting to them.
They need that. It's hard enough to deal with the fact that someone you love is dying. That's hard. But then to try to truly like take in the reality of what this means. So you're going to take medications and you're going to die. What does that look like? What does it feel like? What's going to happen? These are valid questions. And if you can answer those for them, it makes the whole situation, the experience, so much easier for everyone.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Exactly. And it seems to me that it's really important. It would be important to find the right medical doctor to consult with. Although I know in where I live right now in Colorado, I don't think there are very many doctors who will be prescribers. So patients don't exactly have a lot of choices there, but I would imagine the person they consult for information, it makes a difference who that person is and how experienced they are.
Yes. Oftentimes their primary care physician will not write the letter. Some will even say, you're not ready yet, or I don't approve of this. They're very clear on that. And that's okay. You don't have to support it. But I wish if you don't, that you offer your patient some resources at the very least. But that's not what they do. Most of them just say no. And then that leaves that family feeling like their choices have been taken from them again. You know, you can call your local hospice and ask if there is any doctors that they would refer. You can ask if the hospice medical director might, if you can get two to do one and the other letter. There are ways to do this. People do say no. In fact, more so than not, to be honest. But that's not your only choice. So if your doctor says no or doesn't support it or says you're not ready, you are entitled to ask for a second opinion. You are not forced to resign to that being your only option. That's really important for people because that it really detours them, and it also makes them feel unheard and unsupported. And at the end of the day, no one should feel that. They're already dealing with the fact that they're dying. Why do we do that? That's not kind. So if you're not going to support it, that's okay. At the very least, offer your patients some resources of doctors they can go to.
That's so very true. And I could imagine the discouragement a patient might feel if they get turned down. And so this talking about this shows why it's really important for patients to start considering this a little earlier on. If they wait until the last minute, they may not have time to find the right doctors, and they may not have the strength anymore to go out and make visits to doctors and to find the right person to work with.
Well, and you know, you know this. I mean, things can happen. You can decline really quickly. Time is not on your side. And that's why, and I say this again, is why I wish people would start hospice sooner, because it's starting sooner is not going to speed up the process. Starting sooner is just going to offer you a better quality of life at the end of your life, offering you options and resources, which will make this experience a little less difficult for all involved. And if this is something that you feel confident that you want to do, if you get on hospice, then you can push this through and make this happen, whether you choose to do it or not. But having it in place is something that takes little time. So getting that done and out of the way, it just makes things easier for everyone. You don't want to rush around with this.
And in addition to your book is a fantastic resource, but in terms of people finding resources within their own state, can they, if they go to Compassion and Choices or Acumade website, will they be able to find information about their state or maybe an organization in their state that could help direct them toward physicians who will be prescribers?
I don't know. I'm going to say yes. I mean, you can definitely find great information from both of those sites. They're the two sources for me. I go there to them all the time because I want to know how laws have changed, because they do progress. But yeah, I bet you could find that. I think that they would be able to at least allow you to offer you, some choices of where to look for that doctor. And you know, I think even if you called your own doctor, they should have something like that too, or maybe reach out to your social worker wherever you're getting your health care. You could probably reach out to your social worker too, because they have so many resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. And what if a person is already on hospice and has started thinking about maybe they'd like to use medical aid in dying? What's your feeling? Are there hospice nurses who are well informed enough to go to the hospice staff to talk about it? Is that a good place to start? Or
it is. Most hospice nurses are told not to start the conversation. So there's often times where I want to say, you know, you have options. You know, I want to talk about palliative sedation. I want to talk about medical aid in dying. But we're most of the time told not to get that started, which is why I like working as a doula, because I can say, here are your options. I'm allowed to talk about it. But if they ask, then because I do have so much information about it, I'll tell them everything. And then I'll get that ball started, you know, the ball rolling. Reach out to their doctor and I'll ask for, you know, support and get that thing going for them. But yeah, I think that that's important. I like talking to them because they've already built some trust with me and I do have that information. I wish more nurses had a little more information and education relative to this, whether they support it or not. I was told once, not in my company, but I was told once that this patient's she was talking to her hospice nurse and she said she wanted to do that. And the hospice nurse said, oh, I don't believe in that. You should not do that. Hmm. I don't think you're allowed to say that. I had another woman tell me that she called a hospice agency and said, I'm interested in doing medical aid in dying. Do you do that? No, we don't believe in that. Call someone else. Hmm. Why add the negativity and harshness to it? There is no reason for that. You don't have to support it. That's okay. At the very least, respect this person that's calling or asking and offer them some places to go. And if you don't know a doctor who would support it or write the letter, then send them to Compassion and Choices.
Exactly. Exactly. It doesn't quite make sense when in hospice, like our whole motive is to help ease patient suffering at the end of life. It just doesn't quite make sense that we would refuse this option or alternative, which not every patient wants to pursue anyway. It's not like every single patient is asking for medical aid in dying. It tends to still be, I think, somewhat rarely used in many places. So
some have never heard of it before.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would say your book would be the perfect resource to hand out to people who have questions and are wondering what it's like. So if you're a hospice nurse who's never attended a death by medical aid in dying and have no idea how to answer someone's questions, this book is so wonderful. And I wanted to say again, it's a short book and it's a very accessible and very readable by lay people. So you don't use any medical terms or language that people would have trouble understanding. And it's just a perfect guide for someone who just needs their questions answered, who just wants more information.
You know, I envisioned it being something that, you know, if someone does ask, you know, that you can say, here's a book that might help you. I wrote this book with the idea of helping to remove fear, to offer patients who are choosing to do this a little bit of information so they know what to expect, family members. But I also wrote it for the person who doesn't support it, who is against this choice, because I thought if I could offer them just some information, maybe I could ask them that all they do is not walk away. You know, I just don't want them to walk away, because I witness that too. I witness people who don't support it. They walk away from the person they love and say, I can't be there when you do this. I don't like this. I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to support you. I won't be there. And that's heartbreaking. I wrote, did you read the poem in it? About walking away. Can I read that?
Yes, please do. It's beautiful.
This is my whole reason for writing this. It's, we will not walk away. When someone has received a terminal diagnosis and they've been told they have less time, what this translates most to them is that they have been moved to the front of the line, a line no one wants to stand in, a line that can often bring fear, a line that changes everything for them and lets them know that death is near. So many things are taken from them, most importantly, their autonomy and choice, leaving them dependent on everyone and everything, no longer having a voice. So if given an opportunity to say goodbye to pain, to end their suffering and to feel free again, they need to know we support them, that we will not walk away. They need to know that whatever they choose, we are here to stay. I want people to feel safe with their stance. You don't have to change your mind. I'm not trying to change your mind. All I ask is that you don't walk away. And I think one of the things I write in the book is I ask you this, ask yourself one question. Will you regret not being there? Will you regret leaving your friend or your family member because you don't agree? And if your answer is yes, then don't do that, because there are no do-overs. This is one time for this. They're going to do this once and that's it. You will not get this to do over again. And I truly believe that most people will regret not being there. I don't want them to regret. I want them to be able to have peace in their heart too.
And I would imagine that you've seen plenty of these deaths that are amazingly beautiful, very peaceful passages, sacred space with family and those who love you in attendance, and that is something every one of us would wish to have, that scenario at the time of our death. It often doesn't happen for people because family members don't arrive, because no one knows when you'll die. Family members aren't there and they don't arrive at the right time. And so we can't orchestrate that for someone who's just dying a natural death, but medical aid in dying allows for that, allows for this coming together, which is something so beautiful that I think it the beauty of it surpasses the fear and the concerns about it in my mind.
I agree. I, you know, this person's already dying, and to be able to say, okay, it's going to be on Tuesday. I would like all of you here. Everyone gets to be there. They get to say goodbye one last time. They get to, their last memory is of someone who is alert and talking to them and saying, I love you. And they get to say goodbye and they get to witness a peaceful death. But more than that, it's witnessing someone you love be so brave and so fierce to even make this decision. And then to see them take the medications with such fierceness, right? It's amazing the way they take it with such intention. And then they take the medications, and then shortly after they will die. But they did it on their terms. I would want to to witness that for someone I love. I would want to be present for them because I would be so proud of them.
And what a great last act of love, showing love to your person, to be there, to be at their side and to accompany them on that journey.
Absolutely. It's not easy. I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat this or romanticize it. It's still hard. I think if I was going to ask anyone to focus on one thing out of all of this and the choice and the decision to do this is to simply remember that your person is dying and they're having a really hard time. And whether they are in physical pain or gosh, there's a myriad of different things that they're going through, which prompts this decision. That in itself should be your motivation to be there for them and to support this, because what you're saying is, I don't want you to suffer anymore either. And I love you. I'm going to miss you. That doesn't go away. You're going to miss them. That your grief is going to be real. It is hard, but it's bigger than that. It's offering someone the chance to have dignity and autonomy and peace. Mm-hmm. I wish that for all humans.
So very true. And I love that you pointed out earlier, it takes courage to make this decision. This is not a coward's decision. It takes resolve and it takes courage to make the choice and to follow through on it. And so we can dispel that stereotype as well, because it isn't necessarily an easy thing to do. And maybe that kind of leads us into talking about the actual Dignity Day and what might happen on that day, because people do need to know that, what to expect and what it would be like on the day when they actually choose to take the medications.
There is some protocols, and I do put that in the book. And you start, first of all, the medications come, and they come from a compounding pharmacy. And you have two little pill bottles, which is filled with anti-nausea medications. The ones that are most commonly used is ondansetron and metoclopramide. So you have those. Those usually need to be taken about 45 minutes to an hour prior to the actual medications. This is just the medications we use and how we do it in California. And some doctors actually don't wait the full hour. I think that's just a choice thing. We usually wait about 45 minutes to an hour. The bottle of medications, in our case, they come in a brown bottle. It's a compounded, it's a powder, a very fluffy powder. So I always tell people, do not ever open this bottle ever, for many reasons, but it's also not safe. In there, in our combination, is morphine, diazepam, digoxin, amitriptyline, and phenobarbital. It's a very large dose. It's an overdose of medications that have been compounded together. It used to be that you had to mix it with 4 ounces. That has changed in multiple states, which is great because some people cannot swallow that much. So we usually do about 2 to 3 ounces, depending on the person's ability to swallow. You can mix it and pour it in a glass, actually much like this glass, because it's easy to hold. I always bring a straw because I think it's easy, and I always bring colored straws to make it fun. There's 2 things that happen when you drink it. First of all, I'll backstep a little bit. So you've taken your antiemetics, and then you wait about 45 minutes. And I like that time, because that 45 minutes is sort of when the family and the people who are present come together. And this person who's in bed is sitting upright. We ask that they sit up upright as high and tall as they can. I think it's easier for the medications to digest through. And then we ask once again, are you certain that you want to do this? Is this absolutely, nobody is coercing you? No one is forcing you. You are of sound mind. You're able to swallow. We've confirmed all of that. The medications are mixed, and we'll usually do it with 2 to 3 ounces of water. You shake it really good. You want it to blend really good. And then the doctor will give it to the patient to take. And what we ask is that you drink it rather quickly, because if you don't, you fall asleep too soon and you don't finish it, then there could be a chance that maybe it won't work or maybe take longer. You know, I'm not sure. We've never had that problem, thankfully. When you take it down, there's 2 things that happen. One, could happen. One is a burning sensation. And I always tell the family this, I tell the patient this. And what I'll say to them is, you're going to get a little bit of burning. I'm going to look right at you. And I'm just going to remind you to breathe. Breathe in with the nose, out with the mouth. Just breathe it out. And it passes. The throat closes, which happens at the end of life anyway. You know, just before death, the throat starts to close. Well, it does it with these medications as well. The throat will close a little bit and I'll breathe them out. It's okay, just breathe. You've got this. And I'll have them look me right in the eyes. It's okay, you've got this. And then that'll pass. We'll offer sorbet. That's the most common, to have a bite before. If they need to stop in between, then they can have a bite of that in between and a bite after, which soothes the throat. I always have a cool washcloth nearby because sometimes the cheeks get really warm. And usually what happens on average is the person will fall asleep within a few minutes. Now, these medications are strong. They are going to stop your heart, your body, everything, right? It's shutting down and it does it really quickly. So sometimes what will happen is you'll see face color changes. Maybe there will be some body movements and body sounds. Initially, the breath will stop almost completely. And you think for a moment, this is it. And then they might take a big gasping breath again and begin breathing again. The heart will stop sometimes. Sometimes that never happens. So I always tell them the possibility of these things happening so that they're prepared. The patient, the person who's taken it, will not know any of this happened. But I want the family to know, because that gasping sound can be scary. Sometimes things will leave the mouth and the nose. We'll clean it really quickly. And it's usually a liquid. We clean it really quickly. We're always prepared. I am always ready for anything. I always have a basin with me in case they get sick. I'll have a cool cloth to keep them cool. I'll encourage touch. Keep holding their hand. I'll say the things that I do for every patient, which is they hear you. Keep talking to them. They will usually become unconscious within about 2 minutes, sometimes less, sometimes more. Their eyes may roll back, their head may go back, their head may lean forward. That's why we have them supported. We'll sit with them for a little bit until we're certain that the medications have taken place and taken hold. They will slowly stop breathing. Back about a year or two ago, we had a different combination of medications. And at that time, the longest that I'd ever experienced was 16 hours. I've heard of 24 hours, even longer. And that's hard because the family is exhausted. They romanticize this. Oh, they're going to take these medications and they're going to die. Why is this taking so long? And that's really hard for the family. The patient isn't aware of it because they're out, but they're completely unconscious. But it is very hard to sit at the bedside. Then they added amitriptyline, which kind of sped things up a little bit. And then they added phenobarbital. And I consider phenobarbital sort of the hug medication, because that's what I feel like it does. It sort of wraps itself around the human body as it's dying and just says, it's okay, I've got you, you know, and just kind of holds it tightly and says, it's okay, you can let go. So the longest that I have had, I've done about, say, 10 in the last 2 months. I've had quite a few. It's been quite busy. Well, I just did one on Friday and I'm doing one on Monday as well. The one on Friday was less than 15 minutes from unconscious. So it's a lot shorter now. You will expect to see body movements and sounds. And here's the important part, right? The body knows what to do. We have to trust that. And we're hastening it by giving this medication. But imagine the dying process. It's going to go along like this, and things might happen with the body when it's dying. You might have body movement. You might have sounds. You might have some of the gurgling. All of that is kind of common practice. Some of it never happens. Sometimes all of it does. When you take these medications, it's as though you take a portion of the dying process out, right? You go 0 to 60 quite quickly. But then the body does the dying process just like it probably would. So you're going to see that. On Friday, the woman that I was with did none of that. She took the medications. She was unconscious within a minute or two, and she was gone in 7 minutes. And wow. So peaceful. I do believe that it's a combination, I think, of the introducing amitriptyline and phenobarbital to the combination. But I also think there's something about intention. When someone is so ready, they have to be to make the choice, right? But I think that there is this intention that happens with the body. And when that person is so ready, they take it. And I think that's what gives the body permission to let go so easily. It's really quite peaceful. The other thing I've noticed, especially for people who have intense pain, is the minute they take the mute medications, they're still alert. They can look around. They can tell you what's happening. Almost everyone has said, I have no pain.
Mm.
I feel good. So for me, it's really confirming for the family. I want you to know that the minute she takes these medications, she will have no pain. There will be such a sense of peace within that it's relief and freedom. And you get to witness that. None of this removes the sadness. You're still going to be sad. You're still going to grieve. It's still difficult. But to witness someone you love die with that peaceful freedom is beautiful. And I think once they see it, almost every time the family members will say, I wish we knew about this sooner. I wish she didn't have to wait for this. Or I'm going to do this if this happens to me. The awareness is so there of what a true gift this can be for someone.
Have you seen family members who were reluctant and not supportive, but showed up to be there, have their minds changed, and who in the end felt comfortable about it?
Yeah. I have a lot of conversations with people. I write that about that in the book, especially children. You know, I'll talk to children, but the ones who don't understand it or feel like their loved one is giving up, why are they doing this? They could still live a little longer. Why are they leaving me? And I'm really honest with them. I say, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but I want you to hear this. You will have a reaction. You will have a feeling about all of this, but right now, this isn't about you. I want you to see this from her perspective. Have you witnessed what she's been going through? And they'll say yes. And do you want this to carry on? No. What is the wish that you wish most for her? Well, that she's in peace. This is going to bring her peace. And again, just like I said earlier, I'm not asking you to go against something you believe in. I'm asking you to be present for someone you love and not walk away. And almost every time they will be there. Some will say, I'll be there up until they're ready to take the medications, then I'll step out of the room. That's okay. You don't have to be present for the medications. Just let them know that they're not doing this alone, because you don't want them to take that with them. There's ways to do this and still stay strong to what you believe in. But at the end of the day, what matters most is that we support the people we love and that we honor their choices, even though it might be hard, especially knowing that it will bring them peace.
So very true. And I was curious to know if you've ever had anyone who, in the midst of the process, right before they took the medications, changed their mind or decide, oh no, not today. I changed my mind. This isn't the right time.
I have had people change their mind, and I always say, that's okay. I'm not going to push someone to do this. I had one of the doctors I work with and have done many of these with. He tells a story often about a woman that he was with. I wasn't there for this, but he said that they were all sitting around and he hands her the medications and she takes them down and she goes, I've changed my mind. I don't want to do this. And she thought that she was funny, and it was funny, you know, but never have I witnessed anyone changing their mind just before taking it or even in between. It is usually a beautiful experience. It's important for people to know that it's not always beautiful. It's not always peaceful, you know, especially during the time when it was lasting hours and hours, that's really hard. I have seen someone throw up and there's concern because you don't know how much they kept in. I have seen one person who did not fall asleep right away for almost an hour, and the medications just sort of made them almost zombie-like. They stood up and they had this extreme sense of strength, and I was scared. I didn't know how I could hold this person up one time. That's one out of the 100. It's not always beautiful, and it's not always families gathered around. I had a woman that did it by herself because her friends abandoned her. And I use the word abandoned because that's what it feels like to me. And I stayed with her. And that makes me sad. I'm not going to leave someone. I'm not going to let them do this alone. And I think that I'm a good source of comfort, but I shouldn't be the one that's there, you know, and I've witnessed that often where people have walked away, but I get it. I don't want to sound like I don't understand where that comes from. I do, but I want to help you see it differently. You know, I want you to remember that this isn't about you, and I want to help support you to be there, because I think all people deserve that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. That's such a beautiful way to put it. And I think it's important just to reiterate for everyone listening that no one forces the patient to take the medication. It's the patient's choice to take it, and they hold it and they swallow it and take it themselves. And it's not even possible for a family member to get a prescription and force it on a patient. That cannot happen. The laws are there to prevent that. It's purely the patient's wish and the patient's desire to carry this out. And so we don't need to have fears about that. There isn't someone else pushing the patient to do it or talking them into it. It has to be that it's the patient's honest choice. And what occurs to me is that when patients feel inspired to want to do it, that tells me something, like that comes from within them. That's part of their path or part of what is the right way, perhaps the right outcome for them, that they're motivated, they feel inspired by it, and they have the energy and the strength to actually pursue it and to do it. That takes something special. It's not for everyone, but who are we to question them or even to tell them that they're wrong for making that choice?
We're not. It's not for me to say, don't do this. In general, when we choose to do this work, whether it's as a doctor or a nurse or anyone in this field, we make a promise that we will not pass judgment. You know, I say often, I'm not going to judge you for who you pray to, who you kiss, who you vote for. This is your right. I will still provide you with excellent care. And I'm going to stand true to that for all choices. You know, I wish people could see what I see when someone knows that this is going to happen for them, when they have been approved and they've received the letters and they've gotten the medications and it's about ready to happen and their dignity day is about to come to fruition. They're so happy. They don't want to die. I want people to not look at it that way. They're so happy to not suffer anymore. And to know that there's going to be an ending to that. There was going to be an ending anyway. But what's the difference? I mean, here's the point. You can go another 6 months, perhaps, with suffering and still die. Or you can do this now, say goodbye to your loved ones while you're still able to and in your right mind and can verbalize everything that matters most to you. And you get to do it on your terms. And yes, you'll die sooner. But you'll die it without continued. You'll do it without continued suffering. That's what this means. That is what it means to me.
And you'll get to attend the party, at least the first half of the party. You get to be there, and even to view it as a celebration of your life coming to its end. And I don't know. It sounds like it's been really amazing, like the people that you've worked with. And I don't mean to imply at all that it's easy or always goes smoothly, but you're doing such a great service for people by helping them and supporting them.
I love doing it. It must sound weird when I say that, but I feel such honor to be there for this decision, A, because it's so brave and I know what it took to do it. But also that they trust me to be there with them. Some of my patients will ask, Gabby, I want you to be there. And when a nurse who doesn't support this has a patient, they'll ask me to do it. That means the world to me. And when I can sit with someone who's doing this and I get to explain to them and give them this information and the tools to be able to do this with less fear, I'm happy about that. This makes me happy. I'm not happy because someone's dying. I'm happy that someone is dying with less pain. I'm already in this business. I'm already in the dying business. I see death every single day. And it's hard. And the hardest thing I witness is when someone is treated poorly, when their wishes are not honored, when they are not cared for and supported well, and when people walk away. I just ask that you please don't walk away. Mm.
And that comes through in the book and from your poem so beautifully and so true for anyone that we love. I hope that we could be there for them when they need us, whether we agree with them or not. And I wanted to ask you, Gabby, about who is the ideal reader for your book, in a way, if there's a certain group that you would like to see this book in their hands, people who are far away from this, who are wondering and curious about it, or maybe it's a big group. It's not just one group.
There's a lot of groups. That's a really good question, because initially it was for the patient who had questions, the family members who had questions, and those who don't support it, hoping that I can at least soften it for them. But I think what I'd really like is, you know, we were talking about the primary care physicians who were saying no to this. I want them to read it. I want them to read it so that maybe they won't support it necessarily, but maybe they'll be a little more compassionate towards the choice of the patient who's deciding it. Maybe a little bit more lenient towards saying, I will help you in any way that I can. Or here is a doctor that can help you. I'm going to refer you to someone else. So that they may not be holding the medications, but they are holding their hand and saying, I still got you. I've carried you this far. I'm going to give you to someone else that can take this and do well for you. I want the doctors to read it. I want the people who prescribe it to read it. I want the nurses who are going to be present at the bedside to read it. I want doulas to read it. I want social workers, because if social workers and chaplains too, I'm thinking of the hospice team, of course, if they read it, then they might, you know, have some insight of ways that they can bring comfort. And I also want caregivers. And by caregivers, I don't mean the family members providing care. I mean hired caregivers, because many hired caregivers are very against medications in general. I have had them tell their client, I won't give you the morphine. The morphine's going to kill you. And then when they choose to do this, you shouldn't do this. God's not going to be here for you, or whatever they say, well, relative to their faith, they really put that on the client or the client's family. It's uncomfortable. You don't have to support it, but I want you to read this just so that maybe you will be less inclined to put a wall up. It's very hard for someone who is dying to watch walls go up around them. They already have walls up. Why would we add more to what they're going through? I want people who love someone who's doing this to read it, doctors, nurses, anyone who's providing care, and anyone who's curious. I wrote it for everyone, and only with the perspective that it would offer you some clarity. I don't do the clinical jargon. You know, I don't talk about the protocols for each state, and I do that intentionally. That's not why I wrote this. I wrote it because I want to remove fear. I want to honor your curiosity. I want to leave you with less uncertainty. So this book really is for anyone, I think.
I agree with you. And I said before we started recording, I'd love to see every doctor read this, because it offers a bedside perspective that we can't get anywhere else. You can read studies, you can read articles about MAID, but this bedside perspective through your eyes as a nurse and end-of-life doula sitting with patients and helping them, it's a very unique view on this process. And you have beautiful stories to share. And it totally does dispel fear. It dispels all the notions that there's something wrong with this idea or wrong with this picture. And so I think anyone who's curious, or anyone who even has doubts about medical aid in dying, who feels resistant to it and wants to push it away, just read this book. It's short. It's short. It won't take long to read through it, and it will give you a valuable perspective that you won't get anywhere else.
Well, I appreciate that, because that's how I wrote it. You know, I told you earlier on, I think before we pushed record, I have a couple that I'm going to be doing this for on Monday. And I told them about my book and why I wrote it. I wasn't in any way promoting them to buy it. I was just telling them my why. and they bought it. And I called them on Friday to tell them I was coming. And she goes, Gabby, I just want to let you know, I read your book. And I said, yeah. And she goes, yeah. And so did he. And then we read it to each other. It was such a beautiful moment for us to be able to be on the same page. Of course, I support him and I understand this, but to read this book together and to feel a sense of beauty in this choice. And she goes, it was beautiful. And that is everything that matters to me. You know, the fact that they could find that comfort in it, but also to be together when they're doing it. It just, that made my whole day to hear that.
That's so beautiful, so sweet. And what a testament to the value of the book and what it can do for people. I have the ebook, but I'm going to buy the print book. But do you have it? Could, just for people yes. watching on YouTube, could you show it? It's very lovely.
It
has photographs inside.
It has photographs that I took. All these photographs that are in it are all that I took. And they're very special to me, except for this one page, this one with the heart. This gentleman, his name is Christopher William Ether. He does this great photography stuff on Facebook. I've been following him for a while, and he did this beautiful picture of a woman with wings. And it was a little bit more religious than I wanted. And I said, I would really like to use the wings. Can you do something for me with the wings? And he designed that. He took the wings and he wrapped them together in a heart and he gave it to me. He didn't even charge me. He gave it to me so that I could use it. And it's so beautiful. And it's just, it's sort of enveloping that sort of, you know, wrapped and comforted in wings. And I love that. But all the other pictures I took myself.
That's beautiful. I like that vision of being wrapped in wings. And this book is, it's truly a labor of love. And it will answer questions that you have. It will reassure you. It will help you see more clearly what medical aid in dying is really about. And so it's such an important book. And I'm so grateful to you for writing it, Gabby.
Thank you so much. You have no idea how happy this conversation makes me, because I think mainly not just because I like you and I'm honored to be here, but you get it. It's so clear to me that you get why I wrote it and what my intention is. And I feel like that's what we're getting across. I want to ease people, you know, and support them. And again, I know I've repeated this a few times, but encourage people not to walk away. You'll regret that.
So true. Well, this book we're talking about is Dignity Day, but I think people can go to your website, thehospiceheart.net, to find out about all six of the books that you've written. Yeah. And then where can people buy your books?
So you can buy them on Amazon. So I wrote my first four books, which are all, you can find them on the website, all of which have patient stories and just my journey, because I started doing this work late in life. But this book, Dignity Day, and then the End of Life Tips, these two are part of a four-book series. And the idea is that they're quick, easy-to-read handbooks. The other two are going to be coming out in November and December. One is going to be about grief, and the other is going to be about ceremony and ritual and just the different ways that people can offer that. They're all written in the same format, in the same idea, with the same intention, and super easy to read. And the idea is that these could be handed to a family or to anyone, really. But you can get all of them on Amazon. And if you go to my website, there's a whole section that says it's about the books, and it gives the links to all of them.
And they're wonderful books. Gabby's a great writer. Your stories are so, so lovely to read and so inspirational. So get all of the books, I would say, but particularly Dignity Day, if you're interested in medical aid in dying, or if you feel resistant to it, but you need to know more about it. So thank you, Gabby. It's just been so much fun to talk with you.
Thank you, Karen. I am so just happy that we got to have this time together. I think you're wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
That was my kitty. Sorry.
Oh, hi, kitty. Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to the next time we get to talk together.
All you have to do is ask. I would meet you anytime.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Gabrielle Elisa Maness about her book, Dignity Day, and I hope you'll consider getting a copy of that book, because I think it will be really helpful if you're working with people who have questions about medical aid in dying, and particularly about what the process looks like. And as a medical practitioner myself, I found it really helpful to read, just to kind of walk step by step through the process of a patient using medical aid in dying, because I myself have not attended a death using aid in dying. And so it was helpful for me to envision what the process was like, and also just comforting to hear Gabby's stories and her experiences after assisting around 100 patients who have made this choice for themselves at the end of life. So I think it's interesting. It's something we all need to know about. I know this can be a controversial topic, but the fact is, for people who make the choice to use medical aid in dying in states where it's legal, it's really important that we have some idea how to support them and know of resources we can give them to answer their questions and to help families and their loved ones find their way through this process and even make decisions about what is right for them at the end of life. So I'm very appreciative to Gabby, as always, for her writing. And I'll mention her previous book, End of Life Tips, also something great to have on hand on your bookshelf. And don't forget about Gabby's Facebook page, which now has 140,000 members. That's incredible. It's just a testimony to Gabby and how present and compassionate she is. What a great listener and a beautiful presence she is for patients at the end of life, their families, and also people who are grieving. So follow Gabby on social media, get her books, and make Gabby part of your life if she isn't already. And that's, you can go to thehospiceheart.net to learn more about Gabby's work and get a hold of her books there. So if you enjoy this content, I ask you to please share it with other people who might also benefit from listening in. It's really helpful when you spread the word about the podcast and encourage other people to listen. Make sure you subscribe and leave a rating and review for the podcast wherever you happen to listen. And again, if you're interested in offering any sort of support, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support. There you'll find three different ways you can make a financial contribution to keep the show on the air, or on the show notes page, eolupodcast.com, you'll also find a button for the $10 for 10 years campaign if you'd like to contribute with that and help me get a new laptop before mine dies. And I appreciate in advance all of you who have been stepping up for a long time now and making contributions. That means everything to me. So thank you. And next week is the last Monday of the month, so it will be a self-care Monday. I'll be taking the day off from doing a new interview, and I'll be sharing with you a self-care recording instead. And I have to tell you, it's made a big difference for me. This summer, I've done a lot of camping and traveling, and having those self-care weeks when I can take a little break has really given me the time I've need for some rest. And this week, I'll be having cataract surgery for my self-care week, but that's actually really important. It will be great to be able to see out of my left eye again, which has been bothering me for quite a while now. So that's how I'm using my self-care time. I hope you are doing something enjoyable and wonderful to care for yourself next Monday as you celebrate Self-Care Monday as well. So until we're together again, remember, we're here for love. So face your fear. Be ready for whatever life brings you next, and love each and every moment of your very precious life. Bye-bye.